Hey, this is Michelle Lin, and we, on behalf of the Faculty Incubator, wanted to share the Google Hangout discussion that we just had with two editors-in-chief of premier journals in our specialty of emergency medicine. They are Dr. Ellen Weber from Emergency Medicine Journal, or EMJ, and Dr. Michael Callahan from Annals of Emergency Medicine, both of whom hail from UCSF. Now, this is a fascinating look behind the scenes, a look at their journal career, the peer review process, and also tips for budding educator scholars in our incubator group. Now, you can totally tell that Ellen and Mike are not only great friends, colleagues, and incredibly humble with their accomplishments, but they're also both equally inspirational leaders and mentors in our field. There are so many great stories, lessons, and laughs. So let's listen in. It starts with the incubator's chief operating officer, Dr. Michael Gottlieb, who expertly facilitated this discussion.
I just want to hear kind of how did you get to be editor-in-chief of these major journals?
Well, I can say that I did it the way you do so many things. I just kept showing up for the meetings. I guess I have a kind of a genetic predisposition because both of my parents were scientists and editors, and I got involved with Annals way back at the dawn of emergency medicine as a reviewer and then became an associate editor, moved up on the editorial board, and eventually went to enough meetings to become editor-in-chief.
That's it. A little more than that, Mike.
Well, I mean, I have to say, I really enjoy editing. It gives me a great deal of pleasure, and so I was willing to put a lot of energy and work into it, but it's really about all I can say about it. I mean,
a little research thrown in.
Well, yes, actually, Ellen makes a good point. Just so you know the background here, Ellen is the best editor I've ever worked with until she betrayed me and stabbed me in the back and went to edit another journal. Yeah, so actually what she's alluding to is that, a decade or two ago, there started to be some interest in making peer review more scientific because people pointed out, here we have the very process that determines what science is and what science is approved. And there's no science behind how we do that, how we select those papers, what we choose to publish, et cetera. So efforts were made to make it more scientific, and there started being regular conferences. And Ellen and I got in rather early on studying together, generally, various aspects of things like publication bias, why papers that go unpublished do go unpublished. And as you probably know, half of all papers presented at scientific meetings as abstracts are never published in full. So we just pursued the things that interest us in that way and presented those at meetings and published them.
And just kind of building off that, a lot of people, you know, they get involved with journals, they start off as peer reviewers. How did you get from the editors and the decision editors and editors-in-chief? How did you work your way through that pathway?
Well, I think that, and this is true, it's really not unique to me or to Ellen. I think that anybody, and we actually foster this a lot at Annals, the first introduction we get to you as a scientist is when you peer review for us. And we deliberately have fairly liberal criteria for letting people peer review for us, as long as they have some appropriate background. And you learn the craft, and it becomes very evident in a matter of a few years who really likes it, who's really good at it, who's willing to put in all that free work, and who's really doing it for the love of it. And you see the smaller subgroup of reviewers kind of rising to the top, where we on the editorial board say, "Whoa, there's somebody who's going to be good. There's somebody we should develop." And we make efforts to develop them. What that often will wind up meaning is that a few years down the road, you get offered a position as on the editorial board, maybe a very small position, but a position. At each level, you just do what you like to do. You try to do the best possible quality. And that's generally recognized. After all, think about it. The publication of science and these editorial boards is like the greatest collection of scientific slave labor ever assembled, because very few people get paid for any single part of it. And yet everybody does it. So that's how I think anybody would advance. And I would say there's lots of opportunity for advancement, because all you have to do is go in there and demonstrate what your skills and interest and motivation are. And you can do that from a lot of very different backgrounds. Ellen?
So I'll start by saying the way I got into it is it's all his fault. Mike was my chair and my mentor. And after a few years of working for him, he suggested that I might want to try my hand at being a reviewer. I also have a little bit of a predisposition because before I went into medicine, I worked as a freelance journalist, and largely freelance because you can't get a job in that. In fact, one of the reasons I went to medical school is I thought it'd be easier than freelancing, which it was. So I had those two elements. I had my interest in writing and then, you know, Mike encouraging me. And then the other part of it, I think, was that in my own work as a clinician, and particularly when I became medical director, thank you, Mike, we were hitting all these classic problems about operations and crowding. And that interest of mine led to research, which by doing my own research, I became more expert at how to review articles, what articles need. So, you know, one of the things I would say to people starting out is you're already doing some of the work that's necessary to be a reviewer. That is, if you're an educator, you're probably already have an area of expertise. You're writing a lecture about something. So you already know the scope of the literature probably better than any one editor does, unless that's their area of research. So having that background already makes you qualified to review, because you can say this has already been done and don't bother with it. And then, you know, learning, both doing your own research and sort of somewhat stumbling through the articles and figuring out what is something just doesn't feel right. Maybe you didn't have a standard methodological training where you learned what every kind of bias was, but you can say this doesn't feel right. This doesn't seem like the right group of patients to have included. And you do that, and then you read other people's reviews, and eventually you get better as a reviewer. So I did that for a long time. And the way I got to the EMJ was that I had also done a sabbatical in England. Thank you, Mike, for that too. more positively. So I got to know a little bit about the English system. I have some colleagues there. So when the opportunity came up, I just applied for it.
So I like what Ellen said, some things about reviewing that made me realize we need to tell our audience that reviewing is basically quite a lot of fun. But in the process, it also develops a whole bunch of skills, even if you never want to be on an editorial board and you think, well, maybe I'll review 5 or 10 years and then enough of that. You're going to come away with a whole bunch of additional skills that are necessary to be a good scientist, a good educator, a good academic faculty member, because you have to learn. It's a real expansion on how you think when you discuss just clinical issues, even in journal clubs. It goes far beyond that. You have to really learn how to communicate. You have to learn how to think like other people. You have to learn to think how your readers are thinking. If you can't do that, you aren't going to be successful at it. Those are all great skills to have.
Yeah, and I think also if you're, you know, everybody, whether you're a researcher per se or you're a clinical educator per se, you're going to be in the position of mentoring people. Of course, you may also be wanting to publish your own work. And you can mentor people in certain things without having a lot of, you know, reviewing background. But the more of it you have, the better you are able to sit down with a pretty novice resident or medical student and help them walk through how are you going to do this project? You know, what's feasible? What are the pitfalls? All these things that they're fancy terms for it in reviewing, but it's basically how are you going to do this so that you can believe the outcome? And the more experience you have reviewing, the more you're able to bring that to the table for junior people in your environment.
Or even senior people, because as Ellen's saying, like after both done, well, I'm sure thousands of reviews and assessed thousands of projects by now, and you develop this ability, you know, somebody's within a couple of minutes of a presentation, usually it just pops out at you what the weaknesses are, what they've overlooked. These are often very simple things. It's not the fancy statistics that doom studies or cause people to trip over them. It's often common sense operational stuff about how the study was designed and carried out. And it just becomes more and more obvious and more easy. That's a skill that would be useful even if you never did any more reviewing at all, but just being a faculty member, or as Ellen says, as a mentor, or as an author, to be able to avoid those pitfalls yourself.
And, you know, we all kind of do, like, going back to the idea that you're writing lectures about these things, you know, we're all reading papers not every day, I'll admit. And we need to be able to understand whether this is a paper that really would affect my practice. And there's lots of help online, you know, with evidence-based medicine. But when you're, say, putting together a talk on some particular subject, and you have 50 articles to read, you probably want to be able to go through them and say, well, this one showed this tremendous difference in this randomized study. Isn't that amazing? And then you look at it and there's all sorts of flaws and you realize you can't really recommend this method of practice based on this study. So you do have to look at literature critically in all, you know, in practice, in teaching and everything. And I think you learn that as you go, and then reviewing just kind of almost gives it a name.
So building off that, just kind of stepping actually back to what Mike had mentioned, what do you guys see as some of the biggest pitfalls from new authors, from people submitting to they do to try to improve them?
Ugh, there's so many, but you have to know what your research question is and you have to be able to phrase it succinctly. I think a lot of junior people start off saying, well, we're going to kind of explore this and see this. And inwardly, they have some kind of hypothesis or research question, but they haven't phrased it. And if you can't set that out within a few paragraphs of your introduction, you'll have lost the reader. I should be able to predict from your introduction and maybe the last sentence what your methods are likely to be and what your outcomes are likely to be. So it's number one is being clear on your research question. And there's many others. I think the other thing I do see, there's a lot of aids to reviewing, but there are also aids to writing up your paper. And the most important ones are the research checklists. Every type of study that you can name has a research checklist that's available on the EQUATOR network. There's 289 lists. Okay. So it's unlikely you've invented the 290th study type. So go in there and find your study type and use that to make sure you've covered everything in your article, because it goes through absolutely everything that's critical. Who are your patients or who are your subjects? You know, the setting, what was the intervention? And you can lay it out in a very logical fashion. And when that happens, then I get what you've done. And I'll say even more importantly, use that before you even start the project. It's a great way to plan your analysis to say, I'm going to do this study. Okay, who are my patients going to be? What are my methods going to be? What are the outcomes I'm going to look at? So do that at the very beginning, and then you have a much more, your study will go better and you'll have a much more organized paper. I have many more, but let Mike chime in there.
Those are all excellent. I would say that you certainly want to be following the appropriate guidelines for what needs to be reported for each kind of research. But above and beyond that, you need to have a story. So you not only have to have a clear hypothesis, as Owen says, the mistake I see very often is somebody comes up with, frankly, a research question that isn't all that interesting, but that's a different flaw. But it's unfocused because they start thinking of like, oh, you know what? It'd be kind of interesting to see what if this is associated with that? And what if this group does, you know, and they wind up with something that has like 7, 10 conclusions of various kinds, some interesting, some not. There's readers and editors and peer reviewers who are going to read their paper. Don't tolerate. It has to be a story. Story has to have a clean, you know, kind of a trajectory and have an ending. If that means in the end you have to chop out some of your favorite parts, that's too bad. And all that comes down to you have to be thinking from the perspective of the reader, which is a very hard thing for a new author to do because they're so emotionally involved in this paper. They don't want one word to go. You know, they don't want anything to be changed. And you have to really get the idea that a bunch of mean, nasty people are going to come through and make comments about everything. And I say this, it's funny. I mean, I've been publishing for so long and I've published a lot of papers. And I would say it's still true that most of the time when I get the first reviews back from the journal, I get very angry. Not exceedingly angry, but there's something in there that makes me think, those idiots. And I've learned to just say, okay, close the file, go somewhere else, have a drink. And I don't do anything with it for several days, by which time it looks quite different. But I think that emotional component is really important and very hard to learn how to put in a proper perspective.
Well, I'll just jump in on that one because that leads to another very important piece of advice, mistake that novices make. Actually, Mike and I did this study together when we reviewed a number of abstracts that had been submitted to the SAEM meeting years ago. I don't want to tell you how many years ago. The major thing we looked at was seeing whether there was publication bias, that is, whether abstracts that were accepted for the meeting were more likely to have a positive outcome. Yes, we saw a difference. And also whether those were more likely to get published. But then we got the idea, well, there's a number of these that were never published. You know, people submitted the abstract, why not? And so we surveyed the authors of all these abstracts, And we found that on average, they submitted less than twice. So most people gave up after the first submission. And of course, you know, you're all trying for high-end journals where none of us are starting at the lowest level. So you have to be ready to be rejected and to realize that that's not the end-all be-all. Maybe that journal, you know, isn't interested in that particular slant, particularly in education. You may be better off in submitting to academic emergency medicine than to a journal that's more focused on, you know, practice or resuscitation or something like that. So it's not just a matter about who has the highest impact factor, but who is the journal aimed at? And will they find your study relevant to their audience? So the number one thing is don't be, well, I know we said a number of number one things, but don't give up after the first rejection and do use the reviews to make your article better. I can't tell you how many times I've had articles, at least three rejections. And each time when I fixed those things that I was rejected for, the article got better.
Absolutely. And I want to, this is sort of an ethical issue too, which is, as Ellen says, many others have done studies of the fate of abstracts presented at scientific meetings since we did in many, many specialties. And in all of them, typically at least 50% never get published in full. And to not try to get your paper published is kind of an ethical breach because you have subjects that were enrolled in your study and they took their risks or did whatever they did. And for the most part, with no certainty, they would benefit, but with the hope that maybe it would benefit somebody else. So even if the information isn't super exciting, et cetera, that's not for you to judge. Ellen and I found that that's what they were doing. They were, in fact, saying, oh, it's not, nobody will want this. It's too much work. I won't bother. But you really, I mean, I don't know where you draw the line, but I feel you have to submit it a couple of times as a full manuscript. And I might add, the other thing that's interesting about that process is studies evolve so much between the abstract presented at the meeting and the actual paper. We wonder how we can prove that peer review does something, but a presentation at a scientific meeting is not really a peer review publication, presentation of any kind. And there'll be all kinds of balancing statements and key additional facts, et cetera, that will appear in with that. And in fact, sometimes the conclusion of that abstract is completely changed by the time it shows up in a journal.
Another mistake that people make is trying to fit their conclusions to the outcome they want to address that they weren't really able to address because that was too difficult.
Good word.
And or they have a vested interest in making it sound like something that really they didn't study. Or, you know, they analyzed the data improperly and they got the wrong result. Now, if you start out, say, with an article that has you do a randomized study, let's say, and you show a difference. And then maybe a reviewer questions something about that and you go back and you reanalyze it and you didn't see a difference, that should not change the journal's attitude towards your paper. So I think you should understand that if you didn't find a difference, it's still a publishable paper. What we look for is, or your method sound, is it an interesting question? Because if that's what you need to say whether, no, it was the outcome, it doesn't matter if it's an interesting question and your methods were good.
Well, now Ellen set me off on a slightly different direction, but it's a great segue because the thing is you have to learn that you cannot trust yourself. We all are looking, you know, we're scientists, we're researchers. As we say, we're researchers, we're searching for something. Well, when human beings spend a lot of energy searching for something, they darn well usually find it, whether it's there or not, because it would be too disappointing to say, I did all this work and it doesn't mean anything. So you can count on yourself to interpret positively things that aren't really positive. So you have to be very cynical about it. But as Ellen says, the purpose of scientific publication isn't to have 95% of papers produce great breakthroughs. It's the errors or the dead ends in science that actually lead to progress. And this is actually a very sensitive issue, particularly these days, because part of the scientific method is supposed to be replication. So if Ellen publishes her randomized controlled trial and shows that this new drug that she's just patented is really fabulously effective, and I do the exact same study trying to replicate it, which is what's supposed to happen with every study and almost never happens. If I do that and I find that it didn't do anything in real life, what would probably happen? Probably some journals would certainly reject it and say, well, that's not new or interesting, despite the fact that it's probably true. So anyway, negative results are not no results. Negative results are just as good, in fact, probably more important than positive results.
Yeah, I think the more we, Mike and I, practice, the more we realize that doing less may be a good thing. So saying that something we've been doing for 20 years doesn't really work is not a bad thing either. One other thing I will just say that I think novice writers do is they spend a lot of time writing their introduction and their discussion and not enough on the methods and results. We're not saying they need to be long, but that's where your attention should be. I hate reading a discussion. It's the last thing I want to look at. I should really have an idea of what your discussion is going to say by the time I have read your introduction, which is telling me why it's important and giving me at least a hint about the fact that this hasn't been done before or why this study is different. And then you're going to tell me your methods, which I need to be able to read and know, again, that I could replicate your study with what you've told me, the recipe. And then I need to be able to understand your results. So don't write pages and pages of your discussion trying to explain every result or all the significance or do a huge literature. Make it short because the paper is about your methods and your results. I think you have a rule of thumb about the discussion, right, Mike, or Dave does?
What do you mean? You mean the infamous Dave Schreiber?
The discussion should never be longer than the results or something like that.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's right. But I totally agree with your statement about the discussion. And I feel exactly the same way reading them. If you've done it right and you've presented those methods and results clearly and in sufficient detail, then you probably have a story. And then I already know what your discussion is going to say and what your conclusions are. You've convinced me already. Whereas you can write 30 pages of discussion lacking the other parts, and I'm never going to believe it.
All right. So let's say you submit your article and you're really excited. You go ahead and submit. And you get the email back, revise and resubmit. And you're looking through and you're looking at the reviewer comments. And what about when they're just mean or they don't make sense or they clearly did not understand what you're trying to do? How do you delicately or appropriately address that and to still get the paper accepted or brought into a further round of revisions?
Well, like I said, I think that most people, the first time they read the comments, they're going to feel like they're all of them mean and it confusing, or that people didn't know what they're talking about. And that's the emotional side. So you don't do anything about that. You know, you go do something else and leave it aside for a few days or a week. Then you go back. Invariably, you'll find it's not as bad as you thought. Sometimes they are mean comments. Mean comments don't belong in a review. It's a lot of work, but we try to take pains, and I know Ellen does as well, for the editor to go through these reviews and where there's those occasional snotty remarks or mean remarks or just nastiness, to correct that and correct the reviewer. Because one of the major purposes of peer review is to improve the paper and to mentor the author, to help the author do a better job and produce something better and be better prepared the next time around. And you know, you can say the nastiest possible things in a quiet, diplomatic way. You can say how underpowered the study was, how the hypothesis is unfocused, any number of criticisms, fatal flaws. And you can still make it relatively gentle. And it's just a matter of using the right language. It should be kind of in the way you would tell a patient some really bad news about their health. You don't just tell them you're going to die in agony in a few weeks. You find some nicer way to say it.
Yeah. I think people feel like they have to respond to every query by fixing their manuscript. If you have a cogent reason that you did something, first of all, realize that it may have been misunderstood because you didn't write it well.
Right.
So, you know, what I always do is in my letters, I go, thank you for the comment. Then
a little further, you guys, actually, Ellen, we would all say, thank you for the insightful comments.
Insightful comments. And then you say, you know, we're not sure that the reviewer understood what we did here. So here's what we did. And I'll bet just by rewriting it in the letter,
yeah,
you will realize you could have written it better in the paper. If you don't want to change something because you did it a certain way and you know, then you just need to be able to defend it. And sometimes they're just asking you because it's not clear in the paper, you know, that you used a method that normally people would say you shouldn't use, and you just kept using it. You never really described how you came to that decision, you know, saying in a meta-analysis that you know, some people, and I'm probably getting beyond my own knowledge here, if you have a lot of heterogeneity, some people say you shouldn't pull your results. But then I asked the statistician about that, and they said, well, you can. You just have to know there was a lot of heterogeneity. Yeah. So you have to just address that in your paper. You know, we did or didn't have a big enough sample size. Here's why we didn't. Maybe we think it still was good enough because of these reasons, you know, that if we had had a larger sample, you know, the bias is such and such. So a lot of times they're asking you to actually not just rebut them, but change the paper so that the readers understand that the journal looked at what was important in that method and had it addressed.
And what you can do, that's a great example, but you can also do, so you do that, hopefully educating them. Then, and as Ellen says, I think most of the time, I know when I read those responses, I'm usually fairly convinced by the response. They had some good reason for doing whatever it was that they did. And if you feel like it, you can, and it seems like you're getting some real strong pushback from the editor or particularly the editor, you can offer, you can say, well, we did it this way because of such and such. It seemed like the most objective way to do it at the time. Our statistician agrees with us. However, if you know, we could do it, and you can come up with an alternative approach that you're still comfortable with. And rarely, once in a very rare while, it would have too dramatic a change on things. And you wind up just saying, again, kind of diplomatically and respectfully, this would so change the nature of the paper, or this would so change our conclusions that we don't think it's appropriate to do. And then let the editor decide. And that editor may decide that, okay, that's a good enough argument.
What recommendations do you have for new peer reviewers, and how can they improve their skills? How can they get more comfortable? And especially if there's not direct feedback, what other ways can they do to improve their reviewing skills?
Well, I think at both Annals and I think most journals now, when they make a decision on the paper, you as a reviewer get a blinded, depending on how the review works, a blinded copy of the decision letter with all of the reviews in it. And especially at the beginning, it's really important to read all the other reviews and see what it is you missed or they missed or what you caught, and also what the editor said, if they are rejecting it, or what they're saying the major revision should be for, what they focused on. Because if it's a point you made, you can go, wow, I was good there, I did a great job. If it's a point someone else made and you didn't even see it, then you need to kind of think, well, okay, maybe I should think about that aspect. Maybe I should read a little bit about selection bias or something like that so I don't miss it the next time. That's probably the best way to learn is, and of course, doing your own work and having people critique you and saying, well, you forgot this, you forgot this. And Mike will tell you about the value of workshops.
I've made a successful academic career out of proving that all the things I believed in were ineffective. And my record is unbroken. So I've done a number of studies on various ways of training peer reviewers. And it started out because we used to run a workshop at the annual conference, and it was a couple of hours, and we put a lot of energy into devising it, and the participants were very enthusiastic. And I started looking a little more closely to see, well, okay, what exactly is it accomplishing? And participants thought it was excellent and gave very high readings. They were sure that it was going to change their ability to do a good quality review in the future. But then I made a dreadful mistake. I went ahead and actually looked at how they performed as a reviewer after they took this training course, and it had no impact whatsoever. And since then, I've even expanded that to simple forms of mentoring. Because one of the problems here is what you'd like to do, and I think all of us as editors, if we had some nice, efficient method of connecting and having a 5 or 10 minute conversation with a reviewer or an author, where we could give them direct feedback about it. Because, you know, to write the kind of comments that Ellen and I would make to you if we were dissecting your paper, it just doesn't work very well. It's like a thing that needs to take place with conversation. If there was some efficient way to do that, we'd love to do it, but there isn't yet. And I've become convinced over the years. So I did some studies on very simple measures where the decision editor sent an email or have a quick phone call with the reviewer and comment their review. And that didn't have any impact either. And I've become convinced that this is like English composition. You don't learn how to write good English by going in and taking a little quick survey and spending even an hour. You spent hundreds of hours in various levels of school learning how to write English composition and how to improve it and so on and so forth. And this is another level of skill above that. This kind of critical analysis and writing up these responses for a peer review. Anyway, bottom line is nobody that I know of has found an quick, easy, efficient way to do it. What Ellen describes is, I think, the best. And particularly if by some chance when you're peer reviewing, it'll probably happen that occasionally your editor is somebody that you know or is in some institution near yours. So if there's the occasional chance to pick up the phone and talk to them for 10 minutes, you'll learn a ton from it. I'll make one other sort of pitch. Many years ago, the infamous David Schreiker and Rochelle Cooper and I made a training module for peer reviewers. And this was not a real short thing. This was actually one where we give you a sample manuscript. You have to read it and peer review it before taking the course. It then has recorded lectures and samples of good reviews and bad reviews, and we dissect that paper and go through it all. That has not been proven effective either, but we have posted, and it's quite a few years old, but all the points are still relevant. And it's posted on the web for anybody to use for free. You can download the manuscripts, you can listen to the lectures, etc. We have a link to it on the Annals homepage under the Resources tab, which is on the upper right at the top of the page. It says Peer Review Training Module under Resources.
One other thing I would add, Michael, is that we, and I think a number of journals now, when they ask you to review, they actually give you a checklist. I know Annals gives you both a checklist where you can rate, you know, how what you think about various aspects of the paper. So it kind of is a guide to what you should be thinking about. And then you can also give people a list of questions. And we have one on the for the EMJ reviewers that has been used, or I modified from actually, I think, BMJ and another journal for students. The idea is read that and answer those questions. Mm-hmm. And after a while, it will become sort of second nature to you. And there are all sorts of other guides to the literature. You may want to try and discipline yourself to say, well, okay, I'm going to pick up the reader's guide to a study about therapy. And we'll just make sure I've thought about all these issues. You don't necessarily have to comment on them, but you can say, yes, the patient population was appropriate. The intervention was blinded. You know, all those things that we look for have put, especially at the beginning, a little bit of a discipline in it. So then after a while, it becomes a little more second nature.
That's excellent. That's excellent. We'll definitely make sure we're sharing these as well. As far as the next aspect is just with regards to the, over the past maybe 10 years even or so, there's been an increasing rise in predatory journals. I was wondering if you could just speak to what is a predatory journal? How can I identify that? And then why are people concerned about this?
Probably say if it's too good to be true, it's a predatory journal.
That's right.
If you get an email.
If they invite you to edit the next issue, it's a predatory journal.
I think people should realize that unless they get an invitation that is clearly from an editor they've heard of, a journal they've heard of, in an area that they actually work in, that, forget it, okay? You know, we all are getting these invitations. I'm getting them to pharmacy and nursing and I can't even, you know, sanitation, probably poultry science, we've had that. And so you just have to go, look, this is clearly bogus. And then when it gets down to the maybe, you know, this is an emergency medicine journal, which you occasionally get. Usually, if you just click on the, assuming there is a website, you'll find out for the most part that there's a fee to submit a paper. And most journals do not advertise this way. Even the open access ones where you have a fee, they don't advertise with individual emails to individual people. Occasionally one will get in there. It's not that they're all predatory because they charge a fee. It's just that you have to know that they're legitimate. And so if you haven't heard about it, it's probably not real.
To clarify, all open access journals essentially charge a fee. That's what the secret of open access is. Open access just means that somebody different is paying for it. Instead of your medical center or hospital paying a subscription fee, you as the author are paying to publish. But there's now plenty of good quality open access journals. Ellen's totally right. I mean, the predatory journals, they make themselves out to look like they're in first world countries and give addresses in London and that sort of thing. The majority of them are out of Asia. And I've actually had the experience a couple of times of trying to track down some of them that have engaged in plagiarism. And I think it's just a postal drop box or something. And there's a janitor who comes by once a week and picks up the mail or something. You cannot even find out who the individuals are. There's one great aid. So everything Ellen says is true, that if it seems too good to be true, Why would this journal be in such need of publications as to be reaching out to you? What does the New England Journal send you this kind of stuff? No. But there's one very helpful reference, though. There is actually an online list. I think it's BEALS, isn't it? The BEALLS list of predatory journals. There's over 1,000 journals on that list already that have been proven to be predatory. And by predatory, we're not talking about just that they'll publish you if you send them some money. They usually have bait and switch tactics where they tell you it's going to cost you $300. And suddenly when it's accepted, it's going to cost $700 and all kinds of unpleasant, or it never gets published at all. You pay your money and it's still not published. So there's a lot of ways to get screwed. And as Ellen said earlier, before we began this conversation, the people who are most vulnerable to this are inexperienced young faculty and faculty in developing countries who have English as a second language and who need this so much. I mean, need publication so much for advancement. If you're aware of it and the thought enters your mind by looking at that list and applying the common sense screening that Ellen's talking about, that's probably not something that those of us fortunate enough to be in a first world country and high quality training programs have to worry about very much.
Excellent. And let's take this to the other side, the happier side of things. So with non-predatory legitimate journals, where do you see the future of this going? And I mean, a twist to this, in the online era as well, how do you see it with now the online journals as well?
You mean there's some era besides the online era? does the paper era still exist? I actually think, well, it's a crazy time. It's very interesting, you know? It's like we're here for the great disruption of scientific publication. It's the Wild West, and that's both good and bad. You know, a lot of crazy stuff is going on. Change is happening rapidly. Things are not standardized. I'm hoping that what's going to happen is what will come out of it is a better system, because what we've had is paper-based, slow peer review system that was quite thorough. We still can't prove how much good it did, but I still believe in my heart that it did do good. But it was very laborious and depended on a lot of free labor. And it took months or years to send its results out and share them with everybody. And the only people who got to take part in that conversation was a relatively small group of academics. So I'm hoping that someday, using blogs or, you know, like the Alien blog or similar online sources of information and discussion, it would be nice to tie people together better, get more people involved who are less academic as well as very academic. And needless to say, the increased speed of communication is staggeringly great. That's not all good, because really thinking through something and analyzing a study carefully, it just can't be done on the spur of the moment. It takes time. But I think it's basically exciting, and I'm looking forward to, well, in 5 or 10 years or whatever years from now, when there's some new amalgam that incorporates the best of both worlds.
Michael, I think there's two questions there. One is, will journals survive? And certainly journals will survive in some sense. And the yes. reason largely is the entire academic edifice relies on journals, right? And until universities decide that they are not going to judge people based on publication and actually allowing journal editors to decide who gets published and therefore kind of down the road, who gets promoted. That's kind of an interesting idea when you think about it, is that they've kind of given that ability to us, but they need it. We are considered to some extent the arbiters of good science. And so as long as universities see that this is the way they want science evaluated and publication is the way you get promoted, there will be journals. Then I do think more and more we're going to use the facilities of online. But I have to say, I think people still feel, readers, even though they may not open it, they feel that their journal is their tie to their organization. I know I don't do, I mean, I'm in the older generation. I don't go flipping through the Annals website or even my own looking for articles. When the Annals comes, and I know those things have been online for a few months, I stand at my kitchen table and I have a cup of coffee and I read it. So there are advantages to both, but the online allows you to have all these other things, appendices, videos, all these things we could use. And that kind of brings together the best of both worlds.
I totally agree. Journals are not going to go away. People rant about all their many failings, and a lot of those criticisms are true, But I think that mistakes what the function of the journal is. The journal is really a social mechanism for screening and approval. And if you think about it, everywhere in society around you, human beings want ways to judge each other and know in some fairly efficient shorthand way whether this person is somebody I should believe or not. And that's true outside of academia as well as within academia. And we would not be, I don't think any of us would be comfortable in a system where we had no clue what, you know, we'd be getting advice or information from somebody who's typing on this, on a screen. We have known nothing about them. I don't think any of us are going to be comfortable doing that. So the journal serves that purpose. We're gatekeepers. And hopefully we're doing, you know, we're also selecting on qualities there, but we're basically saying, Dr. Weber, this is good enough for you to read if you want to.
Excellent, excellent. And any last comments you have or something else you feel like you want to share with these, again, the faculty incubatees, these young medical educators coming in and just trying to really be leaders in the field?
Can I say something painful? Specifically about educators. And I'm talking about educators in emergency medicine because they're the ones I know best. Educational research in medicine is really not very far advanced as compared to outside of medicine. And within emergency medicine, it's even less advanced, I think. I think it's the most important subject of all, frankly. This is the very way we possess the knowledge that we have. So I can't think of anything more important than improving education and understanding education. But at least like from the submissions we see, and actually I read some education articles in other journals, and a lot of them are not very impressive. They're kind of trivial questions. They're not very well thought out. They don't have much in the way of consequences. And that's because it's kind of early days. All these areas of some sort of subspecialty interest emerge on the scene, and they start out and they're tentative and they're not very strong and they haven't built up the reserve of experience and expertise, et cetera, that they need to. And they all do. I mean, we've watched this with EMS. We've watched this with ultrasound. It will happen. And you shouldn't feel bad about it. I'll just say, it's funny. One of the criticisms that Annals got not too long ago was about how we never publish any education articles. Well, we knew that wasn't true, but then I went and looked at the acceptance rate of our education articles, and it was exactly the same as all the other types of articles that we publish. Well, but that's still, we publish a minority of what's sent to us, as almost every decent journal does. So for educators, think hard about doing research that answers questions that your students or others want to know as compared to what you think you want to know. And don't be oversensitive to criticism, and criticism's how we learn. If you keep getting rejected, I don't think it reflects on the basic worth of what you're studying. It reflects on the need for more education of readers, or for you to pose the question in a better way, or for you to lead us, the rest of us, into understanding why your topic is important and interesting.
I actually was going to say something very similar, jumping on that, which is, I think education research is really difficult. I don't want to discourage people. I mean, people think, well, I'm an educator. That's easy to do. I can do research on it. I think it's actually one of the hardest things to do, because it's very hard to measure if people have learned anything and if they've learned it in a way that's going to make them a better doctor. So people should think about, one of the things we see are the studies where we did this educational intervention and we had a before and an after test. And maybe we even did an after test 3 months later. So, you know, one question is the sustainability, but then is, how does that relate to how they actually practice? I think I'm going to quote, at least it's apocryphal, that Michelle Byros, the first editor of Academic Emergency Medicine, was quoted as saying, medical students are not stupid. So if you teach them something, they'll learn it. So if you test them after a class, they're going to know more than they did beforehand. And so you have to demonstrate the impact of that, at least with the sustainability. Did your educational intervention last 6 months? And with good follow-up, very hard to do with real people. And then also, can you do something that demonstrates how it affected actual practice? That's why I say it's very hard to do it really well. But I think that's what people should be thinking about. If they do get an article rejected, is, were they able to do those, you know, and bring in those elements in their outcomes?
This is not unique to education research, but this is very frequent in education research, and it's frequent in a lot of other areas where people develop guidelines, usually based on some sort of theoretical common sense solution to a problem. and then come up with a bunch of recommendations, which typically require more work by somebody else. And I'm fine with that if you look at the outcomes. And I don't think those proximal outcomes are good enough. I don't care if they still maintain a higher score on something in 6 months. I want to know that, in fact, that, you know, now 90% of the patients were getting care according to the sepsis guideline and getting fluids on time and antibiotics on time, et cetera. It's very rare that the research gets carried out to that level. And Ellen's totally right. It's very difficult. It's still very important. And we're not going to make a lot of progress with this stuff until we start using that as our endpoint. So I say, if you can't show how this changed clinical care or whatever your was, you know, then it's not something that ought to be implemented.
That's outstanding. So a lot of really great points. So first off, just in terms of getting to be in or getting involved in journals, start off as a peer reviewer. You want to work hard, be interested, demonstrate that you're interested, and you can often progress far and be persistent if you're rejected. Oftentimes it does take a series of journals finding the right one that fits what your article is aiming for. If you do happen to get a revise and resubmit, Dr. Callan mentions, Mike says, sit on that for a few days, give it a moment, take your perspective, come back at this, make sure you're addressing all your comments. Now, you don't always have to make a specified change, but you should make sure that you at least address it. You want to make sure your point is clear. Oftentimes, this will be a miscommunication or an end point. So a lot of times, you can explain it and just revise a sentence to make it clearer. If you get a rejection, use the review comments to be improved for the next round. And again, be persistent, resubmit to another journal, but incorporate these points to make it an even stronger paper. When you're looking at comments that are sent back to you, specifically when you get all the different reviews from other people who have looked at this article, look through them, see where you may have missed your points, and then try to focus in on those areas that you may not have been comfortable with or to be a strong reviewer in those areas. We talked about predatory journals. General mantra being, if it seems too good to be true, probably is. And then finally, with regards to the future of journals in general, for medical education within there specifically, think about what people want to learn. You want to target the interests of the learner, not just what interests you as the researcher. You want to really push for those higher level outcomes, demonstrating beyond learner satisfaction or short-term educational outcomes, and really try to see if this affects the downstream changes in behavior or even if this affects patient outcomes. With that, again, I want to thank Mike Callahan and Ellen Weber for just this really, really great talk and a lot of great points. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Yeah, a pleasure. Thanks very much.
And that's a wrap for another great podcast from the Ilium Faculty Incubator. We would love to hear your thoughts and feedback. Follow us on Twitter @IliumFac @ALIEMFAC.